Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to another edition of New Books in American Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger. In this episode, I will be speaking with Christian Philip Peterson, who teaches history at Ferris State University. He, along with William M. Koblach and Michael Lothenthal, are co-editors of the Routledge History of World Peace since 1750. This collection of essays examines the varied and multifaceted scholarship surrounding the topic of peace and engages in fruitful dialogue about the global history of peace in 1750. Interdisciplinary in nature, the book includes contributions from authors working in its field as diverse as history, philosophy, literature, art, sociology, and peace studies. The book crosses the divide between historical inquiry and peace studies, scholarship with traditional aspects of peace promotion, sitting alongside expansive analysis of peace through other lenses, including specific regional investigations of the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and other parts of the world. Thematically divided into six parts, the book offers a broad overview of peace issues such as peace building, state building, and conflict resolution in individual countries or regions, and indicates the unique challenges of achieving peace from a range of perspectives. Global in scope and supported by regional and temporal case studies, the volume is an essential resource for educators, activists, and policymakers involved in promoting peace and curbing violence, as well as students and scholars of peace studies, history, and their related fields. Here is my conversation with Christian Peterson. Christian, welcome to the show.
I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, let's get right to the first question. What in the world is peace studies, and why did you and the other editors decide to put this volume together?
Well, it's a long, convoluted story, but essentially it started, I was asked by a colleague of mine if I would be interested in doing a Routledge study of race relations in the United States, and I did not feel qualified to do that, but I said, I can do peace and human rights, and I don't think there's enough on peace. So I talked to the people at Routledge, and they were all on board with the idea of writing or having an anthology created about the issue of peace, peace history. Now, the crux of the matter is, what does the term peace history mean? Because there's a divide in the field between historians who write about peace, usually descriptive narrative history about peace activism or how to end wars, which I can talk about more later in the interview, versus in the field of peace studies or peace and conflict studies, you have social scientists who are searching for formulas, usually data-driven accounts that are trying to figure out how to make the world a better place based on the use of case studies. Now, one of the editors of this book, who's not with us for this interview, the social scientist on our editorial team is Michael Lothenthal. So he could speak much better about the field of peace studies and peace conflict studies. But from what I read and the submissions that we get, they're basically people are trying to find formulas to make the world a better place across the board. So what you have is, what does it mean to actually be in the field of peace history? And what we decided to do was get a conversation, to design a volume that not only looked at the global issue or the global history of peace, since 1750, but bridge the gap between the historians who write about peace and social scientists who are in the field of peace and conflict studies to get an interdisciplinary dialogue that gave us a better sense of what's wrong with the world and how we can fix it.
Well, you know, the two of us are historians.
Yeah.
So that means that probably this conversation is going to be a little skewed towards the history part of this, but the title of the volume is World Peace in 1750. Now, this seems counterintuitive because most of the understanding of history since 1750 has been a studies of increased revolutions, revolts, conflict, you know, the product of modernity that has, you know, basically upset, you know, traditional societies and traditional ways of having community. So it creates, you know, revolts and all that kind of thing. So how it's interesting. I still don't understand what the topic area is, because it seems like everything that you write historically is always trying to figure out what caused the conflict or the revolution or whatever. And you know, what the issues are, and I don't understand. And we haven't seen very much peace. So what is peace anyway?
Well,
can you define it?
Well, different ways of thinking about it. Peace, I mean, you can simply call it the absence of war, but how the fields generally, and this is for historians who write about peace and in the field of peace and conflict studies, is to make distinctions between negative peace and positive peace. Now, negative peace in the most general sense, and I'm trying to make this as, you know, open to every listener as possible. Negative peace is basically the absence of war. It means that there's not physical violence being inflicted on populations, or people are not experiencing violence. It's mainly the absence of war. What a lot of historians and people, social scientists writing about peace in general, have this concept called positive peace. That means something more than just the absence of conflict. It's finding ways to get rid of things like the structural violence in society, which can incorporate anything from like food insecurity to racism to gang violence, whatever that is. It's finding something beyond negative peace where you structure societies in ways that allow people to live in harmony with their environments, to basically live full, flourishing lives. That just don't mean absence of conflict. And people have all sorts of debates about what that actually entails. And it gets into the way our study is structured is that the introduction deals with how people have framed and understood the evolution of positive peace. And getting back to what you said at the beginning, you're right, that a lot of stuff has been written about war. I mean, we tried to get into the business of giving the other side of it. I mean, writing about war sells in movies, war sells in novels. But the question, especially when you get into the modern world or the advent of modernity, is some people, whether you trace it back to Immanuel Kant's A Perpetual Peace, or you've got various thinkers in other non-Western countries thinking about it, is how to structure society to make war less of a reality and find ways of allowing human beings to not only end the violence against each other, but allow them to live lives that are meaningful and somehow are more than just kind of scraping by. So that's what we're trying to do in this volume, is give people another way of understanding the debates in history that just don't center around warfare. So that whether people like that, or I have to admit, it's a tough sell at times, but I think it's worthwhile if we want to make this planet a better place to seriously deal with the issues of peace and war and how we can fight those forces.
Well, it seems to me like peace studies could be renamed to something that more like what we're talking about here is holistic human flourishing, studying human flourishing and the elements of that.
That's what some people.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what some people would say. Some of the authors in our volume address those issues of how you would get to Linda Groff, for example. The essay that concludes our volume gets into this business of how to structure society's thinking. She's got these various charts and ways of understanding not only history, but the way people live that can answer these questions that very much deal with what you just said, the term holistic living.
So if a historian's looking back on the past, we're going to be looking a historian who's emphasizing peace would have to then look to the past and see if we can find examples of when this has occurred. And I'm thinking about the Puritans very early on when they had their city on the hill, mm-hmm. and how they envisioned what they were living out and their vision for their society at the very, you know, which didn't last very long, but it was there for a little while. What do you study? What is your object of study in the past to put an emphasis on this holistic human flourishing? You would have to find examples in the past of when this has occurred.
You'd have to find examples of it. Some of these, the essays in our volume deal with that. But what also is, like, you raise a good point, because whatever, especially the Puritans, their example of shining city on the hill, most people would say it didn't really work because it was an unattainable ideal, and they had trouble with Native Americans right from the beginning, excluding them in terms of civilization and citizenship. That results in things like King Philip's War and whatnot. But what you can look at it from a number of different angles. Like, one of the things that our introduction does is get into these debates about what peace means in practice. I mean, beyond the definitions of negative and positive peace. What historians who write about peace do is try to find those moments when human beings lived in peace, but also talk about how you can change international relations, like world transformations, how you organize international society to best promote peace. And there's all sorts of debates about that. You get into social movements. How have people understood war, challenged war, tried to produce societies that were less likely to engage in war? That's when you get, like, the people in the late 1800s, private citizens, you know, working for either socialist solutions to the cause of war, arbitration arrangements, social activism, you know, the peace advocates that tried to prevent World War I, for example. So you get into things like that. And then you get into what you would call conflict management. Once you have wars that are already going, how do you basically organized ways, for example, whether it's the Palestinians and the Israelis, once you have conflicts, how do you end them and how do you structure societies after to make sure they don't happen again? So you have all these issues where at times it looks like it's very hard, because most of human history is, it's a lot of warfare, it's a lot of conflict, it's a lot of hatred. You're trying to find ways to kind of turn the tide back and find arrangements to deal with all the human problems that we've had. So you've got to look, to my mind, when you look at the issue of peace, it's, you know, you can find examples of when human beings living in peaceful solution or peaceful times, but it also is the story of how people have challenged war, try to restructure society to prevent wars from being as frequent, peacekeeping missions. And I can say more about it if you're interested. There's a big controversy right now in the field of peace and conflict studies and peace history in general. Kind of a pushback against kind of democratic peace theory, or what a lot of scholars call the quote unquote Western liberal or neoliberal peace theory.
Right. Yes.
So, yeah.
Because I'm thinking back to the Puritans again, within their community, they believed that they had established a viable society. Now we look at them now and we think, well, look, you excluded the Indians. You were not living at peace with them. But within their society, it's very subjective, right? Who decides what is peace and what does peace look like? And it seems like it's a kind of a community by community basis about how we arrive at that. And so it's really, I think it's really complicated to try to, you know, define that. And I think what you just pointed out, yes, can someone from the outside come into a community and impose upon them some sort of system or some sort of ethos that we think is more, you know, will produce more human flourishing for all people, when their tradition, whatever it may be, may be resistant to that?
Absolutely. It's a fundamental issue that we deal with in this book. Like, I'm going to mention some authors here, but it's in no particular order. I mean, we have a lot of good articles in the book, but Michael Carpenter's essay about peace power from below in the Palestinian-Israeli disputes is a great example of this, because he really faults a lot of the elite Palestinian Authority and others for really screwing up arrangements that people at the grassroots level have for basically dealing with their societies in terms of peaceful relations, in terms of improving the Palestinian communities and dealing with the current political situation, that a lot of times you have international institutions, you have peace activists who come in, whether they're international actors through private groups or through international institutions that come in with blueprints that they're basically going to implement without consulting the local knowledge, taking local conditions into account. Like this cookie cutter approach to peace based on if you have elections, if you have markets, if you just have democracy, that you get this cookie cutter blueprint, go into a community and say, this is how peace is going to be. There's been a lot of pushback against that because a lot of people are saying not only it doesn't work, but it actually, in many cases, is actually harmful to societies. So a lot of what we did when I structured the introduction along with my co-editors, one of the questions or one of the things that we made that can bridge the gap between social scientists writing about peace and historians is how historians' close attention to the different local contexts, the different history of peoples, can be central to actually making the blueprints that social scientists come up with work better. If you have a better sense of the local context, local knowledge, what worked and hasn't worked in the past, you're at a much better chance to promote peace than just coming in and say, this worked in Tanzania, so maybe it will work here, without knowing the history and background of the people.
Yeah, I'm thinking of an example in the United States between the old South, the South before civil rights, okay? Jim Crow South. When people came into the South to promote civil rights, a lot of the white Southerners said we were fine until the Yankees came in and stirred up, the black population. Everything was fine. We all got along. We were, quote, in peace, Now you stirred it all up. So it's kind of interesting because it's very subjective about whose peace, what peace, whose peace, how you define it. And I don't know how you even find a situation where what appears like peace, because there's no visible act of violence or conflict, maybe, but there's still a lot of unrest, a lot of unhappiness, a lot of people not liking the status quo.
What you've just described here is a good example of the difference between negative and positive peace. I mean, you can have a population that, there's no violence, like there's no armed uprisings, but people are suffering from everyday systemic violence. Like I don't want to go into a whole history of race relations in the U.S. South, but the fact that you have, the problem of lynching for a long time. You have the Jim Crow system by itself is an argument every day that you are not equal to somebody. The school systems, the oppression that people felt on an everyday basis, that would be an example of how people would say the society that has that type of arrangement by definition isn't in peace, and it's not going to be in peace until you basically get rid of the systemic violence or basically the arrangements that degrade people by definition. And that's when you get into the issue of why so many people think that it's very misleading just to assume that peace is the absence of warfare. It encompasses a whole different number of factors that you have to say a society is in peace.
So it makes it really difficult to study the past, I think impossible, and to find an example of this, of a positive peace. I don't know where you would find that. I think you would end up talking about the underlying conflicts that are there, that maybe they're not, there may be negative peace, but there's not positive peace. And so again, you're having to focus in on the conflict and the problem. And there's something about history that historians tend to write about some sort of conflict. It may not be violent conflict, but some kind of ideological conflict, religious conflict, ideas, political, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's not a conflict, I don't know where you would find a society that doesn't have that, doesn't have a conflict. Every society has some sort of conflict, even if they don't have outright war. So I don't know how historians would write it about that unless they're looking for attempts.
That's how I would frame it. like, to me, I mean, this is just my view, and I, you know, I'm coming from a historian's perspective. To me, it's like writing about the ideals versus reality. Now, any society, as far as I know, is going to have problems in terms of resource allocation, race issues, class issues of some sort, political issues. Even a country like the social democratic paradise of Sweden, if you follow Swedish politics at all, they have their own issues, whether it's immigrants or whether it's arguments over market reforms, whether they're moving away from the social democratic model. There's going to be problems in any society, but you still study and you can still make distinctions. The difference between a country like Sweden and the United States or Canada or wherever, there's still a scale where you can make distinctions based on the actual conditions on the ground. Like, there's definitely an ideal. I don't know if any society for, maybe in Star Trek, like I always think of, when I think of like a utopian society, I imagine in Star Trek where everything seems to get made on time. No, because maybe machines will eventually take this over in some type of flipped Marxist world of the future where machines create everything and it's just redistributed naturally. I doubt that will ever happen, but who knows? I won't be around for it. But you can still make distinctions based on society. So you can study things and look at this society in terms of how the paradigms of understanding structural violence, the history, or positive versus negative peace. You can still make, I think, useful distinctions studying various societies. And in my idea, it's just like, go ahead.
So I think you can, basically what you're talking about is doing some comparative histories.
Mm-hmm.
How two different societies or three different societies have dealt with maximizing human flourishing and thinking about, okay, is this society closer to maximizing, you know, they have a path forward to maximizing human flourishing versus this other society who won't even acknowledge that there is any problem?
Yeah, and I'm going to muddy the waters further because people define happiness differently. I mean, you've got people, you've got Western with the Bill Gates Foundation or whoever come in and basically, or the United Nations, it doesn't matter, have their own versions of how you should be happy. It's, you know, being consumer-oriented capitalist society with elections. Some people, it doesn't build. That's why I think the local context and knowledge, I think, is so important. And it's these typical debates you have about the modernity itself being defined as a Western kind of construct of how to organize the world, and some people not on board with that. And then you get into all these obscure intellectual, maybe not obscure is the right word, but you get into these intellectual debates about what modernity means and concepts of multiple modernity.
Right, because
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. Because this is kind of what I found in the book was that that a lot of the conflict is the result of what I call the result of modernity. The nation state, migration, breakdown of traditional societies, the rise of the individual, liberalism, capitalism, globalization. I mean, it seems like these, so it's like studying modernity and how do you put that genie back in the bottle? Because I think the only way, you know, you're going to get human flourishing is returning back to, or not returning, but reconstructing some sort of communal model of how to organize society at the community level, because people don't live globally. People live very locally. Okay. We have internet and we have all that. So we think we're global citizens, but actually we're living you know, in a little piece of real estate.
I agree with your insights. It's a challenge, and people have been grappling with these issues, like the issue of a blanket international identity to promote world peace. I don't think that's going to work because you hit the nail.
No, I don't either.
Most people are focused on their most people. I mean, I just gave a talk on this in my university about. I was on a panel talking about the rise of tribalism in the modern world. So I'm aware of some of these issues, but people start with their families, their communities, especially times of economic dislocation. They tend to rally around their self-professed tribe. Nationalism is an offshoot of this, like the nation state, people coming back to this community, whether it's in Europe with the backlash against the European Union or people like Orban in Hungary to what's going on in the United States. I think there is some truth in that. Now, what some people have grappled with, I wish we had an essay in our volume about Giuseppe Manzini in Italy during the 1800s. I think he dealt with a lot of these issues of how to responsibly reconcile nationalism and internationalism, kind of the enlightened nationalists, like a bunch of democratic nationalist countries that would cooperate together on their own terms internationally, where people would have healthy democratic nationalism instead of having it be, you know, toxic patriotism or nationalism or warmongering or some of these issues.
It seems to me like a lot of this has to do with the psyche of the human psyche. It's very difficult for us to love humanity in the abstract, you know, universal humanity. It's we tend to love particular people. We tend to love people within a circle of influence around us. And we seek to live in harmony with those people. It's very hard for human beings to try to transcend that very local particularity. So we can call it tribalism, but I think is a way of just saying, it's wrong, instead of saying, okay, wait a minute, this is maybe something that about human beings that we need to acknowledge, and how do we make that be, good for everybody?
Well, yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's the perpetual struggle. I mean, you can look at the new book by Fukuyama about identity, I think is going to be nailed on both sides, left and right. The right are going to hate it because, it's an apology for identity politics, and the left are going to think it's doesn't celebrate identity politics enough. This is just my take. This could be wrong. But it seems to me that he's trying to figure out why human beings seem to be. One of the issues he deals with in the book is that human beings have this innate drive for recognition, that they want to be basically seen well in the eyes of others and so forth. And he develops all this stuff, but there is something innate in humanity where we want to be considered, as good as anybody else. We're driven more by recognition than by, say, bland economic forces. Because people are wondering why people seem to vote for politicians who enact policies that are not in their economic interest. Like, I just give you one example, a quick one. I know somebody who literally had an operation saving their life because of the Affordable Health Care Act. And they voted for politicians who are openly trying to get rid of it. And you try to square that, and you ask him about this, and he basically thinks that the politicians he vote for are more important because they recognize my identity. They seem to have something that calls to him that economics isn't as important to him, or healthcare isn't as important to him, to the overall message of the people speaking about America first or taking back the country. These issues seem to resonate more with him than abstract economic issues.
Okay, Christian, one of the things that happens in your book here is the idea of that we can teach peace, educate people towards peace. And I was wondering if we can really look at it that way, because isn't peace really the result of pre-existing conditions on the ground? In other words, people have to have a fair allocation of resources, bodily security, a trusted authorities and traditions that undergird the person before you can even have peace, instead of thinking that you can just teach peace. Now, you could teach conflict resolution, but I don't know if you can teach peace.
It's debatable. And the person that would be much better positioned to answer this question would be Mike Lodenthal, our editor from who's a social scientist guy. But in my understanding of it, I think you can teach peace in ways that just address the issues, give people the main understanding. So you're going to have a class, I think you use like peace study readers to address all these major issues, conflict resolution, positive versus negative peace, perhaps get into nationalism versus universal values. I think you can raise the issues and begin people to think about things like what patriotism means in practice. Like you can, the patriotism can take many forms. Could it be self-critical, addressing problems, or is it jingoism, warmongering, nationalism? I mean, if you're going to use peace as a piece to basically turn people into, like basically any type of violence is bad and war is never good. I don't think you're barking up the wrong tree. But the way I conceive of it as a historian is to give people different views of complex events.
So let's talk again. How does race and gender theory interact with this field?
It's an important part because historians who write about peace and social scientists in the peace and field of peace and conflict studies like to, especially in terms of peace and conflict studies, consider themselves interdisciplinary. So to write about the systemic violence of a lot of different societies, you need to be able to go into the field of race studies and gender studies or women's studies, however you want to put it, and grab theories and ideas from those fields to give people a better sense of what the problems in societies are. You want to be able to basically take theories from a lot of different disciplines and use them in ways that elucidate what is wrong within society. So you have examples of essays in our book written by various authors who have things like they will use statistics and talk about, draw on a number of different theories to show why UN peacekeeping missions, the effectiveness has been compromised because women haven't been, despite the pledges of countries, women have been underrepresented in United Nations peace missions, or why women are being underutilized on various peace missions across the globe. So why I would say they are important is because at the end of the day, race has always been a factor in how human beings have related to each other, and it becomes an important topic in how peace is framed, especially not only wars between countries, but the kind of the issues of systemic violence that's within societies. A lot of times it deals with understanding basic racial theory. So I think they're valuable tools in the toolkit of how to better address and explain peace issues throughout human history.
The other issue is religion, because in religion, you know, you've got like peace movements where there's a lot of religious people involved. There's also a lot of secular people involved. And there's been the hard secularist position that part of the problem with the world and the conflict is religion. And other people would say, no, if you're going to solve the problem of conflict, you have to deal with religion and you have to bring religious people into it because you're never going to solve it if you just decide that you're just going to exclude them because you think they're the problem. So how do historians and social scientists who work on peace studies deal with the issue of religion in peace studies?
It's a very good question, and it's a loaded one, and I like to take it in a couple different ways. One, a lot of the religious stuff in our book deals with peace activism, especially from the late 1800s into the early 20th century. There were a lot of religious groups that kind of thought of themselves, whether it's, you know, very hardcore peace or pacifism, like war is never good, to people who define defensive war, to the issue of conscientious objection, that you need to know the religious background, how people have challenged wars and tried to get governments to change their behavior. You've got to have a grasp on the religious angle. And getting into the secular issue, there are going to be some headbutting on this issue, but I think to be realistic, people who are like very anti-religion and very secular oriented are going to have to wrap their heads around that peace can be a way to help, or excuse me, religion can be an issue that can be harnessed to promote peace. It just has to be done effectively. There was one author whose name is escaping me who we didn't get, I tried everything but throw the kitchen sink at him to get him in this book, who I did a podcast interview for New Book Network's World Affairs, who did a very good job of describing how religious authorities in the former Yugoslavia have been made an important part of the peace process of trying to settle the former disputes, that instead of like just sidelining them because they're religious, whether it's Muslim or Catholic or Orthodox, that they've been brought into the process and that has helped at least on some level deal with some of the peace disputes. I think we have to wrap our heads around the idea that secularism is important, but most of the people on the planet believe in religion. They believe in God. And you can't just expect that these forces will be taken away. depending on time, place, and context, religion can play an important role in the peace process. Does it cause a lot of death and destruction? Of course. The last time I looked, so did a lot of secular ideologies in the 20th century. They caused their fair share of damage as well. And some people would even be nitpicky, I guess, or maybe that's not even the right word, but would talk about a lot of peace activism has failed in the world. That liberal peace paradigm of creating a secular, separating church and state, society, free market capitalism, liberal democracy, has not really done a particularly good job of promoting peace across the planet, that it might have more success if it incorporates religion, does a better job of addressing the issue of religion.
Okay. The thing that really got me going here was when I was reading about the social science criticism of history, historians that we're just engaged in a descriptive narrative and not offering any solutions. Yeah. And you know, it really got to me because I do think of history as moral inquiry. And really, it's the way society reflects on its past. We reflect on our experience in the past and try to get meaning out of it and figure out, you know, who are we from what's happened to us. So the critique that history needs to be more scientific seems sort of, you know, kind of wrongheaded to me. Which, of course, one of the things that you talk about in that introduction is about the whole argument of the rational actor and trying to like pin down through some sort of, you know, qualitative sort of analysis of what are the elements to create, you know, peace, with assuming that you have rational actors. But I think that's kind of wrongheaded too, because we know people are not making decisions just based on a calculus of, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. People have all kinds of motivations. Religion's one of them, family, alliances and loyalties and ideological persuasions and, you know, how they're feeling that day.
I agree with you.
Yeah. So I'm wondering how in this field of peace studies or the you can actually have history and the field of social science fields work together, unless you have social scientists who are willing to kind of understand, have a broader humanistic understanding of how people operate. I don't see how this field can hold together, is what I'm saying.
Well, I'm sure there'd be a lot of people would like to, who are in the, I come from a historian's background. So I'm sure there are going to be other people who listen to this and, you know, want to like jump on and get into the debates. But it seems to me, just by what I'm thinking, everything I read suggests that a lot of social scientists have thought about this critique, and they basically think they're doing a good job of incorporating history. I know people that have worked for non-governmental groups say that we try to understand the culture of any society we go into. Now, you have that critique out there. It seems to me that people are, the things I get by the various like big names in the field of peace studies that I mentioned in the introduction of the book, they talk about this kind of this hybrid forms of peace. I think the field is moving in a direction, local context, local knowledge, various ways that are more historically animated. Because the definition, if you take the idea that the people, you say you're going into a peacekeeping operation, that local knowledge should start first, you should work for the people and work yourself out instead of coming in with, we're going to have this liberal blueprint to produce peace and just impose it on them. You have to be more historically minded by definition. You got to know the background, the history, the customs. You've got to figure out what's worked in the past. I think by definition, the field is moving in a more historical direction based on what I'm reading. Now, it gets into how you're going to frame it. Because the critique that I kept seeing over and over again and talking to people, and there's a big divide. I have numerous examples of this growing divide. Like, people would read something like, this is an example that I just off the top of my head, of the people, of the peace activists in the 1930s who tried to prevent World War II. Like, what if you read a narrative description, some of these articles deal with the issue, and it doesn't work, like what's the value of that? Like, what do you mean? So what that people like put conferences in Nanking that opposed the Japanese war in China? Like, so what? Like, what's the importance of that? So then you've got to get into the questions of what to do in the here and now. I kept hearing this argument, and you're right. I don't think it's fair. I'm not trying to say this is the correct argument, but the argument is like social scientists go out into the field, they collect statistics, they do background, they come up with blueprints to make this world better now, whereas historians basically write about random subjects in the narrative form that are of limited value. And it gets into the whole John Lewis Gaddis book, Landscape of History, how he frames the difference between social scientists and historians. Now, one guy said to me, and he said he was simplifying by 1,000, but he said this to me was the difference between history and, at least as he understood the field of peace studies, was that historians draw on a lot of stuff to write, he put it like this, they draw on a lot of stuff, a lot of specialized research, they use a lot to explain a little, whereas social scientists use a little to explain a lot. That to him.
Well,
was
I would have to object to that. Well, you know, it depends on the history, who's writing the history, what they're doing. I mean, but the thing about it is, the criticisms that I saw there was also about the fact that we don't deploy theories. You know, we don't create theories and we don't deploy theories. And I think that's simply wrong. I think most historians have a theory of running in the background. Okay, mm-hmm. And they just don't foreground it. You know, they have a theory about what caused a certain conflict. You could say a theory of what's going to bring peaceful. You know, we borrow a lot of theories from the social mm-hmm. scientist.
Absolutely.
We just don't put it in the background. What we do is we put flesh on those theories. Okay, so that we can we can actually see whether this really works. I mean, you don't really know if a theory really works unless you test it in history, I think. I think that that's what we do. We test our theories in history, in the past.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I'm just trying to lay out the arguments for both sides because we designed this book to try to bridge the gap because the hostility on many, like as I write in the introduction of the book, like there are people who basically big wigs in the field of peace and conflict studies who basically openly brag about not reading history. I had a guy, I won't name his name, who went to a conference, a peace history conference. I won't even give you more than that, not to give it away. But he basically gave a little panel presentation on the importance of studying history and peace. And he said he was borderline shouted down by the audience. Who is historians to tell us what to do? Why? Peace, why should we care about something that happened 100 years ago when people are starving now? One graduate student got up and said, who are historians to tell us what to do until they decolonize their field?
Ooh, wow. That stings.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Apparently that person's never been to the AHA conference recently, but that's another issue. But my point of it is, I'm sympathetic to the historians' arguments, but we did try to be in our introduction to lay out both sides in ways that we'll at least begin the process of bridging the gap in the dialogue.
And the other thing too, you know, history is a narrative, even if you just say it's just a narrative, but I think we can also, historians not only do moral inquiry, not only do we test out theories to see and put flesh on those theories, but the other thing that we also do is we evoke the imagination of what is possible. Yep. And I think that evoking of the imagination, I think is and reflecting on who we are and how we got here is crucial. So it seems like we're more willing to use, you know, social science tools to do our work than what you're talking about. Some of the people on the other side are not willing to consider the value of what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting debate because I've had people respond to me about the essays in this book and the introduction in all sorts of ways. Like people have either thought it was great, other people thought it was terrible. But I wish if I had done this again, I would have had a chapter that was written by somebody who's had experience actually working on peace missions instead of just being academic about it. Because I know some people who've worked for the Bill Gates Foundation, who have done work in Haiti, who have done work in Senegal. And they basically say that a lot of the academic stuff that they read by social scientists, they understand that they're going to have to bring a history component to it once they get on the ground. Like they're not just going to go in with what they read about why peacekeeping missions haven't worked in Haiti. They got to get to know the people. They got to get to know the history. That there's a difference between theory and practice once you get into the field. that I think we could have captured better with an essay on that subject in this book.
Well, especially if you're talking about something like Haiti, they have a history in their stories, in their folk tales, in their songs, in their art that is full of information, I think, useful information for social scientists, and also that can inspire inspire people, that can evoke an imaginative idea of what Haiti could be.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like, if you just go in there and count how many kids are starving and how many hospitals there are, I think you're not really understanding this, what the solution is, because a lot of the solution is already within Haitian culture. The solution is within the culture, which means you've got to understand the folk tales and the stories and the music and all that.
Yeah, you raise good points. The trick, as I can see it, is to find ways to meld that all together. Who's going to meld it all together in ways that actually help the Haitians in ways that they define as acceptable? I mean, because like I said, you can't just go into a country and tell people how to live. It's all there. To me, it's potentially there's fruit for dialogue. And what you're saying, I'm very sympathetic to, because I'm, like I said, I'm trained as a historian. Maybe we can find ways of getting along better.
Well, this is what I'm going to ask you now can social science and history coexist in peace studies without denigrating one another? Because it seems to me that the projects are so different. And this particular volume has got so many different elements in it. We've got every kind of thing in there. You've got religion, education, ecology, arts. There's so much it's so big, it's so broad. I'm not sure that you can even begin to bring these two wings of knowledge together. So, what do you hope these essays will give the reader? Because it got me riled up.
Well, a couple things. I'm hoping it educates people about the evolution of peace in 1750. There are obviously a lot of gaps in, even with 35 essays, we couldn't cover every subject. There's some glaring things that should be in here. And if you've ever undertaken an anthology, you know the process. I mean, what people agree to do and what they actually end up doing is quite different. I don't know what else to say about that. We had essays that were promised to us that never materialized on very important topics, Haiti being one of them, for example. But what I'm hoping people read, not only they're educated about peace issues, think more about the issue of peace, digest the terms, but I'm also the interdisciplinary dialogue. I really think there has to be something resembling breaking the ice. Because right now I'm not very, very optimistic about the dialogue based on all the stuff that I'm hearing at conferences, amongst various editors, but I think it's an important discussion to have. Because if you just have people sitting there on either sides of the camp hostile to each other, you're not going to really, I think people, and to use your phrase, we need to have some creative imagination where people read outside their discipline. Like, I don't think it would be kill historians to read more social science accounts of peace building missions, successes and failures, just like I don't think it would kill social scientists to read more history, even general histories of a country, even reading a novel, a Haitian novel, for example, could go a long way. There's a good guy. There's a guy I did a podcast with for New Books Network. I believe his name, and I'm going to be mad at myself if I get his name wrong. John Bao, who wrote a book called Realpolitik that I did a podcast for, said it best, I think, in his conclusion, where he said diplomacy, people, instead of thinking about realpolitik and theory, people could do a lot better in their diplomacy if they read more literature about a country instead of just thinking about theories. So I think he's on to
absolutely
something. I think he's on to something there. And I think it goes both ways. But to me, we have stuff we can potentially learn from each other. I just, right now, people are tone deaf. We need a leap of imagination to begin that process going. That's what I'd like to take from this book, at least as a start. And historians will be sympathetic to their approach. Social scientists will come back. But maybe there's something we can benefit from.
Well, it seems to me you need a follow-up book between two authors, a historian and a social scientist, having a real conversation in a book about their different approaches to this field and where the commonality, possible commonalities, and where they can collaborate. And I think that would be a useful book. Really useful.
No, I do too. It's one of these things where I bandied about a bunch of ideas. I'm trying to finish some books and projects of my own. I need 36 hours in a day. And I'm sure you're in the same boat. It's actually funny you mentioned that because a friend of mine has actually suggested something similar. And we're just kind of in the very, very preliminary process of discussing how to actually do that.
And also this conflict between social science and history, it doesn't just apply to this particular field that your book is on, but no. I think it kind of runs throughout, you know, the 20th century.
Oh, absolutely.
And we're still dealing with it, and you know, how these how we're going to look at the world and how we think each field can contribute. So. How do you hope this book will be used?
I hope it's used in a couple ways. I hope it's used, it becomes like a mainstay of, obviously it's a very academic book. It's priced, the general reader's not going to pick it up. But a lot of the times, what I'm hoping it's used for is for scholars to read it and take it seriously, and then use it not only as a reference, but they use it in for selected essays in graduate and undergraduate classes. But that they use it to inform their work, to find a way to say, this is an interesting approach. Next time I write something about peace, I'm going to try to look for the insights of different scholars and have that inform my work. But like a lot of what I envision this book as is one of the standard scholarly references that people writing about peace history in either the social sciences or in history, historians who write about peace, it's a work that they will consult on various topics, using classes when they need more information. Because one of the things that I think it does well is we have authors from a bunch of different countries. I mean, not just, we have Americans, Canadians, people from Norway, Egypt. I mean, we have a lot of different places. So to not only use it as a reference to trace the evolution of global peace history, to become a useful reference and something that people can use in their classes, and ultimately increase the dialogue among historians and social scientists in ways that produce better work over time. That's how I envision it.
And obviously, this book is not skimpy. It's got like 34 chapters plus an introduction. So there's a lot there.
Oh, yeah. It's not something you're just going to sit down and read in a weekend. What's interesting about this is I worried about the length, but Routledge was very clear they wanted a book at least this long. I mean... We were about where they wanted with the word count when we started off on this project. It seems to me at times I was worried that it was way too many essays, but they seemed to want at least, I think it turned out they wanted 30 to 35 essays when it was all said and done.
Well, thank you, Christian, for this insight into this book. I appreciate your time. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger.